Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1007. If you're going to be in Dallas, Texas, or the surrounding areas, I'll be at the Addison Improv July 25, 26, 27, doing the stand-up comedy jokes. And then also August 8, 9, 10 at Goodnights in Raleigh, North Carolina. Ticket links for that should be up at id10t.com/tour. There's other dates being posted in the fall, like in Chicago, for instance, and some other ones. So go there. Get tickets. Come out to a show. I'll sign stuff. Whatever you want. Like I always say, I don't even care if it's anything that I had anything to do with. I'll write my name on whatever you would like me to write my name on. So that's all that. But let's talk about you, the ID10T community. On the corkboard, events at ID10T.com, like Michael Rhodes, who writes, I want to tell you about this awesome website I am a part of. It's called Depression Warriors, and it's meant to be a community of people that live with depression and can interact in the forums to help others that may be having a hard time with their depression. The site is founded by a mental health professional who is available to chat inside the forums or through private messaging. Membership is only $12.99 a month, but the first month is only $9.95. This allows you access to the private forums as well as messaging a licensed counselor. The website is depression-warriors.com. We're just getting started. There's a ton of content still to come. We're also on Facebook at Depression Warriors AR and Twitter at DEP Warriors. Brandon writes, my friend Robert and Jonathan have made a great podcast about all things geeky and pop culture called Forgot My Dice, and I really want to sing its praises. Mainly focuses on board games and RPGs, but touches on movies, TVs, and TV and books that they have recently consumed or are looking forward to in the near future. They've been doing the podcast for a couple years now and are a great resource for reviews of new indie or Kickstarter board games. They've also had several guests like game designers, fantasy sci-fi writers, voice actors, and industry insiders. They help get the word out for new and upcoming games for developers that get in contact with them or are just generally funny and friendly hosts for anyone who loves board games and RPGs. This is a great bi-weekly podcast for all your geek news. Thank you so much to the folks who submitted, and events at id10t.com, again, is how you can get your thing up on the corkboard that you made, or someone that you know made, or a thing that you just like. This episode is Chris Kattan, SNL alum Chris Kattan, who I've been acquainted with for almost 2 decades, and he's written a book called Baby Don't Hurt Me. It's available now wherever books are sold. And Kattan is a sweetheart of a guy and has such an incredible story that it's so fascinating that he just didn't really feel comfortable sharing until now that he's written this book. But he's a good dude who lives a sober lifestyle now and just has a lot of stories and is was a really, 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 really fantastic guest. And there was a lot of stuff that we talked about that I didn't know, that I hadn't heard of, but just a lot of good nuggets about overcoming things that happen that you have no control over. So here's the ID10T podcast number 1007 with Mr. Chris Kattan.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
to see you.
It's great to see you.
How have you been?
I've been well.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I didn't know about. But
Are we started? Did we start?
Yeah, we started.
Oh, we did. Oh, that's so nice.
I remember the first time I met you in was in Aspen Comedy Festival in like 2001.
Uh-huh.
And
is that where it was?
It was.
Okay. I didn't.
Unless it was so at many like people Groundlings or something before that.
That must have. It may have been that, but I don't. There was a lot of people in that Aspen event. That was a whole. What were you there for? Were you doing a show?
I was probably in 2001. I might have been doing stand up.
Okay.
I was either doing stand up or I was there like with a little comedy movie that I was in. But I had done stand up at Aspen a handful of times. I just can't remember if that was the first time or not. But I was definitely there. That was such an amazing comedy festival.
Yeah, it was. Well, we were there. Or I was there because that was a SNL reunion going on. But it was like old, you know, Farley was there, you know, and Mike Myers. And I remember that's why we were there. And there were other things. I know Tina and Rachel had a show.
Oh, yeah. Dratch and Faye.
Yeah, Dratch and Faye.
Yep.
And but yeah, there was a lot of people. That was my first event that had anything to do with any alumni of any sort.
Oh, really?
Regarding SNL, yeah.
Oh, my God. So you guys...
We were all like Will and I and Molly, and we were all just like, oh, my God, look who's here. Like, we were just all freaking out. So it was our first time that we ever got to see, you know, previous cast members from the same show.
That's insane.
You know, before, you know. Plus the elevation of it made it even more. The elevation of Aspen made it more exciting.
You come into the equation lightheaded.
That's right.
Yeah, constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I remember, like, at that time, I was still drinking, and it did not take that much. It took a couple of drinks before you're like, whoa.
Right, exactly, yeah.
I don't feel so good.
No, right.
Yeah, it's not good. But it was I think at a certain point they realized that it was so expensive to do the festival up there.
Yeah.
And HBO used to broadcast those comedy specials
from
up
there. That's right.
But
you're right. Aspen Comedy Festival,
of course. But then at a certain point they were like, yeah, this just costs money.
Yeah, it's too expensive.
Yeah, this doesn't really make
sense. Yeah, it doesn't make sense to see Nicholson skiing and that. Why base it all on that, you know?
I was always surprised and delighted by the fact that you're in this weird mountain retreat with like million-dollar art galleries.
Right.
Like, why are you? Why would you just go to Aspen? Like, you know what? I'm gonna. You know what I should do? I should just go buy a million-dollar painting.
Yeah.
At the same time.
I know. It's like that, or let's go to the island of Capri in Italy, just to get some linens.
Well, I always found that the performing there was really interesting because you had a strata of three different types of people. You had super rich people,
right,
who didn't always relate to normal people.
Yeah,
you had all the people who worked there who were in service of those really
rich people,
yeah,
of course.
And then you had a layer of entertainment people who were sort of naturally like jaded anyway.
Right.
So it was a kind of a
yeah.
Did you perform there, or did you just do a live?
Well, that was just. I don't know what we were doing besides getting together and representing the fact that we're on SNL. I think that's all it was. Oh, I know. It was a panel. I mean, it was a group of us on stage. Was it Charlie Rose? I think maybe Charlie Rose was our moderator.
It's Oh my God, I don't remember, and I don't remember if I saw. I don't remember if I saw that or not. It was just. It was so long ago now. Oh my God!
It was.
It was like 18 years ago.
Yeah, I know.
But it. What were the exact years you were on SNL?
96 through 2003.
96 through 2003.
Yeah.
I've always found that SNL has this kind of phenomenon that happens where whatever cast you grew up with, people always go, that was the best cast. And any new cast are like, well, it wasn't like those days.
Yeah.
Did you have that experience when you were growing up with SNL?
But they were.
You're like, oh, but the new cast is great, but Billy Crystal. You know what I mean?
Right. I think I don't think anyone thought our cast was the best at the time.
Really?
No. And we didn't think that either, too. We were very it'd be weird to be in a cast thinking we're the best also. But we were very green and very we were really literally like not ready for primetime players, which is good, which would benefit our way of creating, because we never got too excited about anything other than what was going on in the show itself. You know, we weren't getting hired, outside of the show that often, and then come back to the show like they do now. Like, you could be on SNL now, and then you're in a Judd Apatow film the next week.
Yeah. You know. Then you're in a Hulu series. Right, then you come back. Series, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But back then, you know, we were very, you know, so it was very, just being on the show was enough, you know. But I don't, I think for me, the best cast was the one that I was brought up watching, and that was the, you know, the Dennis Miller, the Dana Carvey one.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Mike Myers one. That was the one that, what I liked the most, you know, that's what I was brought up on.
Well, that was when they first, like, that whole, oh, we can spin these into movies.
Yes, yeah.
Like, because Wayne's World came out of that.
Right, and then, Wayne's World.
You know, yeah.
And I think they did Coneheads during that time, too. Even
they did Coneheads around that time, too. Yeah. Yeah.
But that was the cast that I, you know, I was really, which made me want to get on the show. Well, actually, Eddie Murphy was what made me want to get on the show, and that was previous to that. That's what really excited me.
Yeah.
Mostly. His way of performance, his confidence and his, he was just so confident. He was like, it was like
you couldn't take your eyes off him.
It was incredible.
Anything
like
he was
Amadeus.
Doing.
It was like Salieri. Yes. It was going through Eddie Murphy or something. Like, this boy here sings. Why him? God chose him.
Yeah, you can throw your crucifix in the fire.
Exactly.
We are enemies now.
Yeah, that's another level. But I mean, he was so amazing to watch. So yeah. that was really my influence. And then, but growing up, to see like a conglomeration of like people and how they worked together was that Dana Carvey group and Mike Myers and Dennis.
And Mullen. You were Groundlings, right?
Yeah, I was Groundlings.
Was your mom Groundlings?
No, my father was Groundlings.
Your father was Groundlings.
My mom was a model in the 60s, and she came from Hungary, and she escaped during the Iron Curtain. There's a whole passage in the Baby Don't Hurt Me book about that. And my dad was came from Chicago, and he wanted to he did stand up like in the 60s. He was in a like he was in Jerry Lewis was a teacher of his.
Oh my God!
And so it was Stan Laurel. He was friends with Stan Laurel, Laurel and Hardy in the
60s. Holy shit!
He has all this great history, but he was one of the founders of the Groundlings.
Right.
So when I was like
that's
seven,
the connection. Yes,
yeah, that's
yes,
the connection.
Yes.
And his name is Kip King. They changed it. Was
right,
Jerome Catan. They changed it to Kip King for...
That I knew. I guess I...
Oh, you knew that.
Somehow
nice,
there was a blank spot in that I knew he was... I knew someone in your family was a foundational member of the Groundlings, but I didn't realize that like foundational meant actually founded.
Right.
Because that would have been
that first cast
of the Groundlings was probably like Pat Morita.
Yes, it was. Like, right. Lorraine Newman. And John Paragon and Paul Rubens.
Yep.
Who did Pee Wee Herman, of course, and Cassandra Peterson, who did Elvira,
mm-hmm.
and Phil Hartman. And after that was, like, I think, John Lovitz. But my dad left by then. But, you know, and then that's, well, it says in the book, but I don't know if you read it, but my dad would, you know, take me, would bring me to the shows on the weekend. So I got to see him perform, you know, as like a seven-year-old, watch him on stage, and to see your father was really cool. To do improv with these people, and
was he happy that you wanted to pursue comedy, or was he like, "It's a rough life"?
He was,
kiddo.
Well, he was a little bit in that voice too.
Yeah,
but no, he liked it. Yeah, but he was very he was very specific in not that he was teaching me comedy specifically, but he was like, you know, what he was interested in. Was very specific. It was like, you know, there were like, if he introduced me to the Marx Brothers, there were like only three or four of those Marx Brothers movies, like Duck Soup and Night of the Opera and Day at the Races and Horse Feathers were the best ones, you know, and don't watch the other ones. So he wasn't like teaching me that, but already my taste was going in that direction.
Right.
For some reason, I did like Road to Rio and Road to Morocco over Road to Singapore. Or, you know, like it was very... I don't know. It was similar to his taste.
You were brought up with a basically like a comedy nerd.
Yeah, comedy
like,
nerd.
But
with
this.
Good taste.
Right,
you know,
right.
You know, let's watch The Flintstones with canned laughter.
Still holds up, though. Still holds
it's
up.
It's always weird that the Flintstones had canned laughter. Remember that? They had
I know.
A laugh track.
I think it would have been funny if they had just animated a live audience and the camera
would
just
would
reversed
make more sense.
To, their,
yeah.
to their live audience yeah. cracking up. They didn't
exactly.
They didn't do it. But when you – so when you started at the Groundlings, was the – because I, you know, at that time, the comedy landscape was a lot different. Now there's a million outlets to do stuff. You can just make stuff on social media if you want. But at the time, was the path Did you think, well, I just want to do comedy? Or did you think, I want to be in Groundlings, I want to do SNL, I want to do movies? Like, was there a specific pathway that you saw?
Yeah, I wanted to be on SNL. That was my dream.
Well, that worked out.
Yeah, it did work out, yeah. It was, so it was when I was in the Groundlings, they're the best group to teach you how to write, too, by the way, for not just sketch, but like movie scripts, too. They really, it's incredible what they do, how they teach you how to write about characters and scenarios and situations. And, you know, so that they really, you know, it's incredibly educational. But that, yeah, I wanted to be on SNL. So that's why I created a lot of characters at the Growling stage that ended up being coming on SNL. You know, like Mr. Peepers, mm-hmm. the monkey character,
yep.
or the gibberish guy, Sewell Forrester, who spoke gibberish, and the Roxbury guys with Will. We created those at the Groundlings. So.
And was that part of your audition when you auditioned for SNL?
Yeah. So the Mr. Peepers and Sewell Forrester and what else? Oh, I just did some guy humping a couch. That wasn't really a character.
Oh, did I start the audition?
You know, just, the guy. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was already humping a couch before I got there.
And was it just Lauren sitting in the, like, in a big space? Or?
For the audition?
Yeah.
It was on at home base, you know, where we say, you know, the home base. And so we were on that stage facing the audience, but there was no audience. And it was dark. It was pretty much the only light that was coming in was on that stage that you were standing on. And in front of you was, not right in front of you, but further away from you was Lorne and supposedly Marcy Klein and Steve Higgins were there.
Yeah.
But they were not laughing. At least they weren't during my audition. But they said they weren't laughing because they were also live via satellite for Burbank for NBC to watch.
Yeah.
You know, during they were watching the auditions as well. So they weren't supposed to be laughing, but that kind of threw you off because, you know, you're used to doing – it's like doing stand-up and then nobody's going to laugh. It's kind of a little off-putting.
It's like trying to surf with no waves.
That's – like, yeah,
oh,
exactly,
what am I supposed to – oh, no,
yeah,
we're not, like, you're not going to have waves this
have
time,
waves
but
today.
You need to surf.
Yeah, but act like you just hit an 8-footer. Yeah, exactly.
But I guess in those moments, if you – as long as you're committed to your character
– yeah.
And pretending like it's there,
right?
Then it probably helps,
which is amazing discipline. But you weren't given a heads up.
Yeah,
you know, that wasn't happened. But yeah, so that was pretty nerve wracking. The audition, we're all very nervous auditioning.
And what was your first show like?
The first show, well, I did not get the when Will and Sherry got the call to do SNL, I did not get that call. Because I didn't – what happened was I was back in Boston with my girlfriend on a weekend that I happened to miss a Growling show. And I'm usually there for every show. You don't usually ever miss a show.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to be out the weekend that Lauren decided to go to the Growlings to check us out. And I wasn't there. And nobody called me and said, hey, come back to fly out. You might want to be part of the show. And nobody told me that. So I'm not blaming anybody, but
no, but that was at a time where people just left messages for you somewhere.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
You had to retrieve your voice messages.
That's true. Yeah,
no one's gonna text you and be like, "Chris, where are you?"
Exactly. Yeah. So it'd be like
the urgency wasn't. Communication wasn't there.
Well, so yeah, I left.
Didn't you get the carrier pigeon we sent?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh yeah.
So I didn't get back in time for that show, and so I didn't start the show when Will and Sherry did. And then I started the show like that same season, but 6 weeks prior to the end of the season, which is a weird time to start.
Right.
It's not even mid-season.
Right.
So when I started, I was I started when everybody was you know, in the process of the middle of the show. It's like coming in the middle of a school year, you know, and it's already, you know, classes already started. So I jumped right in, and the first sketch I did was called Substitute Teacher, and it was the gibberish guy, the Sewell Forrester character that, you know, was like, good afternoon, I'm Sewell Warner, going to be your substitute teacher, Miss Asa. And, which is fun to write that, too, by the way. And so I did that sketch, and Lorne put it as the first sketch of the night. So I had a great first show. My first show was the first sketch of the night, and it debuted a character. So he... he totally supported me, and I did well. But I think I also did well because I wasn't I was just thrown in. I just started when everybody had already been in the process of doing a season. I mean, you know, it was six shows more and it would be the end of the season. So
right.
There was something being about not having that excitement anymore, you know, because there was no time to be excited about, like, oh, I'm on a new show.
Because
so
you're just
fun.
Dropped in the middle
you're
of it.
You're dropped in the middle of it. You're like, okay, you're starting now.
That's probably good.
It was good.
Because you can't get in your head.
That's what I mean. There was no time to think about it. There was no time to question anything. There was no time to any of that. You were just like in there and did it. And that went great for me. That worked perfectly in my favor as a performer. So,
I mean, to me, the great steeplechase of being on SNL, I would guess.
Yeah.
Obviously not ever having done it, but is the internal steeplechase of, because obviously comedians can be, you know, we can be an insecure bunch. We can be a very hard on ourselves.
Sure.
We can be looking for validation in weird places like, oh, my sketch was put third and not first, or this got cut, or this. So
that came later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I had always heard that Will was good at, like, if a sketch didn't go well, he'd just go, hey, we sure stunk up the joint there, huh? And then just move on.
Yeah.
Which seems like the best attitude to have.
He's very good about that.
Were you good at that, or did you internalize stuff pretty hard?
I internalized stuff pretty hard, but I was also very lucky. I got a lot of my sketches on. You know, I worked hard, and I Lauren put a lot of my stuff on, so I didn't really – I mean, I did internalize, but I also – because I started a little late, I didn't have time to get to know the writers a lot on the show. You know, and when you start on time like everybody else, you have that time to meet everybody else and you know, hang out with the writers, and therefore the writers are going to want to write for you a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But because I just was thrown into the lines, or not really the lines, but because I started a little late, that it wasn't – I didn't have time to really get to meet anybody. So I ended up writing for myself mostly, which is fine because that – helped me get my sketches on because I knew specifically what I wanted to do. Like,
right.
I could decide for myself, like, what characters I wanted to debut whatever week I wanted to. So, and I had quite a few characters I already created at the Groundlings. So,
which, again, you had sort of envisioned that this was the path that you wanted to take.
Right.
So you prepared yourself for
exactly,
it.
Yeah.
So you were ready when the opportunity presented itself.
Yeah.
But I remember at Aspen, I think you were there with Scott Wainio.
It's Scott Wainio,
and I was so in awe because I saw a sketch form.
Yeah.
There was I think a U2 song came on.
Uh-huh.
And you go, oh, this should be a sketch. And it was
like
a weatherman sketch. You go, it's a beautiful day. And you and I watched you start pitching. Yeah, but it was so silly. And I watched you start.
That is a silly idea.
I asked you to start. I mean, like, I watched you start pitching jokes to him for this thing. And
right,
I was like,
right.
Oh, my God, it's happening. I'm watching it happen right here. So I don't know if that sketch ever. I don't know if you ever developed that into, like, YouTube weatherman.
The Bono weatherman.
Yeah.
That's
pretty
funny.
But it was really fun to just see it. Like, to see it happen in real time was really fun.
I think, the elevation, again. That'll really happen in Aspen.
What did I say when I was up there? I don't know.
So many great ideas. I got to go back there. I mean, when you're in the thick of it, you know, and you're around the right people, you're always riffing, you know. You're constantly riffing, and it's that other part of your brain that just likes to think on your feet and not really get lost in the conversation.
Right.
You're like constantly, you're riffing, you know, which is hard for other people that have normal conversations to jump into.
Yeah.
And it only works with other comedians usually, you know, that can just keep up with you.
Well, SNL is still one of the few platforms where you can go from being someone who's, you know, really funny in your comedy group to all of a sudden being famous overnight. Everyone knows your name.
True.
And that's, I would imagine, pretty mind-fucky too, especially back then, just because, you know, like, obviously now sketches get passed around online, but but in the late 90s, the mid to late 90s, viewership numbers for an average television show, like shows that would get canceled 20 years ago, would now be on forever with those numbers. Like, if a show had like 5 million viewers 20 years ago, it'd get canceled. Now it's like that show's on forever. But you, but I would imagine from the time you started appearing on SNL. Now it's people are like, oh my God, Chris Kattan, it's Chris Kattan. I mean, were you prepared for that? Does that fuck with your head? People shouting, you know, Mango at you in the streets? Or did you like that stuff?
Oh, I wasn't prepared for that at all. You mean the very beginning when it started?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it was...
Do the monkey guy!
Yeah, it was fun at first. Yeah, it was very exciting. You know, it's like being... It's like saying somebody loves your haircut in a way, I guess. That's not a good analogy. I love your haircut.
Do that hair thing.
Do that hair thing.
Yeah.
No, it was fantastic because it was like, it means it's working. Whatever you're doing, you know, the character you just did is working and that people like it. It was immediate feedback, you know. It was, you know, and you could relate it to like YouTube as you know, and see how many viewers were there. Of course, it was just like 2-3 people yelling at you on the street. So it's not quite the same amount of viewership, but it was, it was fantastic. Yeah, it was very cool. It was immediate. And of course, being a, you know, kind of an insecure comedian, you thrive off of that. You know, you need that feedback or you need that someone to say they love that character, you know, because you didn't get it from the show. No one's going to say, well, I mean, that's not true. Some supportive people would do that. Some other writers, cast members would say, hey, that was great. But the person that really mattered was Lorne. You know, you wanted feedback from him the most, and he wasn't going to give that to you yet. For a while, you know.
Well, this might be a weird question, but I'm really interested in the idea of not just achieving quote-unquote success, but maintaining it.
Yeah.
And when it kind of goes sideways for people, because we always, when we're young, we always have things that we think, if I get this thing, then I will feel whole. I will feel validated.
Right.
Then you start to get those things. And like you said, in the immediate moment, you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I think I'm fixed or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, but it never lasts.
Right.
And then it's, you know, do you think that success and fame, the sort of dangerous addiction of that stuff, or how it fucks with your head, or how, like you said, oh, that came later, like the way insecurity stuff, that came later. Mm-hmm. Like, what is there a sort of a cautionary tale, or what was your experience with that as, you know, as you spent 7 years on the show, your kind of growth period?
Well, I was, let's see, I was insecure at first. Let's see, I'm trying to think about that. I was stable. Well, no, I guess, I don't know. I think when you get used to somebody on the street, like, acknowledging you, you know, and your characters, then you're like, okay, that's immediate validation. And then you hope for that the next time you do another character. And if you don't get that, then you get insecure. And it's hard. You want to find... Well, I got a lot of feedback. Actually, you know what? My relationship with my dad, he was there. He was always there watching. He gave me feedback. You know, he would always give me feedback after every show.
Was that good, or was it like...
No, it was good.
Oh, good.
No, it was good feedback. He wasn't like, oh, you should have...
Yeah, you could have... Yeah.
He was actually not good in the sense that he was always... Everything was wonderful. He's like, oh, it was wonderful. And everything was almost too good.
Yeah.
And I wanted more criticism, actually.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
So I wanted a little bit more like, well, Daddy, not everything is wonderful. It can't be all wonderful. Like, what was wrong with it? So I wanted him to tell me... What was wrong with it? And he would tell me what I could have improved on. So he became my sound base. He became that, you know. So I didn't have to find it too much with other people on SNL as much as I thought it would have to, which was healthier. It wasn't fair to my dad, but I think he enjoyed it.
Well, I you know, from what I understand now, because especially, you know, what you talk about in the book, is when you severely injure yourself in a sketch and are afraid to tell anyone about it.
Yeah.
I feel like that might be the downside of wanting to protect success, because you are sacrificing your literally sacrificing your health and well-being because you don't want to cause a ripple and disturb the thing that you've built.
Right. That's correct. Yeah. I did not want to affect what I've worked on so hard, you know, and worked for. And you know, I was at a really solid place on the show, and you didn't want to be taken out of the game, you know? You didn't want any...
Even for a minute.
Well, I didn't even know... It didn't feel like it'd be taken out for a minute. It felt serious. It felt like this is serious. And when I went to the doctor, went to Lauren's doctor, and he's the one that first diagnosed me, and he was like, you need to have surgery. And I was like, that's obviously going to take time. And therefore, I'm going to have to put it off. And if I bitch about this, you know, injury, then people are going to say, maybe you should not be in the show this weekend, you know. And I do not want to be taken out, like, for weeks. I mean, you know, I mean, like any other fan that's watching the show will be like, where is that guy? You know, and I didn't want people to, not just people in the cast to judge me for that, because they wouldn't, they really wouldn't, they wouldn't protect you. You know, people weren't going to be like, oh, we'll make sure you're okay when you come back and write for you and stuff like that. You know, it was competitive, but a healthy competitive way, you know.
Right.
But you couldn't rely on that, you know, exactly, you know. It was really up to you to rely on yourself. So when you're taken out of the game, you just didn't know. And you didn't know how the public would react, too. I mean, what would they say? Would they say, like, oh, you're now disabled and you're unable to be funny now? Or
especially when you
I didn't know.
When your whole thing is that you're the most physical comedian on the show at the time. All of your characters are so physical.
Yeah, that's true too, yeah.
I mean, it's almost like a piano player who breaks a hand.
Yeah.
It's like, oh
yeah, it was not, you know, and they were like, I mean, I didn't do some of the physical characters as much as I did during that time, but I did do, like, I remember this one Mr. Peeper sketch I did with Cameron Diaz, and like, my the left side of my body was, or especially my arm, was all atrophied. It was like half the size of my right arm, and I'm left-handed. And when I was watching the blocking tape afterwards, I saw that, you know, my left arm was appearing more than my right when I was holding on to Will when I was entering the stage. And I was thinking, how can I – can I switch sides as I enter, because I wanted to hide it so bad, you know? And, you know, I just did not want it to be – I just didn't want to be judged. I didn't want to be – criticized, or I didn't want anyone to go like, what's wrong with that person, you know, and just taken out of the game publicly or on the show.
Right.
You know?
Well, just for, I mean, I'm just in case people don't know.
Sure.
In 2001, you're in a Golden Girls sketch. I think you were playing Sophia, maybe.
I think so.
And
I don't know which
you were
one
all
was
sitting around a round table.
Yeah.
And you do a pratfall. You lean back in your chair.
Yeah.
And the impact.
I throw myself back.
You throw yourself back. Sure. And the impact of the frame of the chair.
Right.
Snap, crack. Your spine.
Yeah, well, my neck kind of went back, or did one of those $1 million
live
things
on television.
Live on television on the top of the chair, the top frame of the chair. And so that's where it kind of went back and snapped, I guess. And and so I got up, you know, I wasn't like laying down like, oh my god, I'm paralyzed, because it was you know, I was just pumped full of adrenaline. I was like, you know, still going, but it didn't feel right. It didn't feel good. It was painful, but it wasn't like debilitating, like I can't move, I'm paralyzed, anything like that, until like maybe 3 or 4 days later. I think it was like that. It was a few days later where I just was on a date, and I lift my arm up over I put my arm up over, you can't see this, obviously, everybody.
He's putting his arm over a chair.
I put my arm up as if I'm putting it over the chair, I guess. And that, whatever that did was, made this it just really was insanely painful. Like, I was like, oh my god, I can't, something's wrong. Like, really wrong in my neck. Something's wrong. And it just like, it was a feeling of like all the blood got cut off in my arm. Like, all of a sudden now my fingers are getting numb, and like, it just got worse. And that's when I knew there was something wrong with me. But I thought, I was just hoping the pain would go away. I thought like, oh, I hurt myself, like a bruise or something, you know? I mean, it was obviously a lot more intense, but you know, I just never, I never hurt myself like that before. So when you have a new injury or a new level of pain, you don't know what to make of it, you know, no matter how painful it is, you know? But it wasn't, you know. So I was trying to hide it as much as I could, and I did. I hid it for a long time, you know.
Well, when was the first surgery?
The first surgery was after that season.
Right, immediately after that season.
Yeah, exactly.
And did they put a pin in your spine, or did they try to fuse the...
They did. They tried to fuse it, and they called it non-invasive, which is weird because it is invasive.
Yeah. If someone is touching your spine, like, bones... Yeah.
Well, I didn't want... Well, the first doctor that diagnosed me in New York, Lauren's doctor, was like, you know, you need to have surgery. And I was like, what does that mean? Are you going to put like a car part in my back? Because I was like freaking out about that. And he's like, yeah, you're going to have to put a plate in there. And I didn't want to do that. So I found a surgeon in, I think it was Calabasas, and to go to after the end of the season that I would go to that did non-invasive surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But that's still invasive, like I said, but he wouldn't put anything in there.
Sure.
But he would do fusion, so
right.
That's what he did. But the only problem with that was that, you know, wasn't going to be, they would say like it'd be 80% better, which means you might have to do it again.
Right.
Possibly, but you may not have to regarding your physical therapy. So I was thinking, okay, I'm not going to have to because I did non-invasive. I'll get away with this. You know, this will be enough for me. You know, I could deal with a little bit of the pain, but it was like, it did not happen that way. It was not, it was just too painful. It just, that 20% or whatever that amount of, it just was still painful. And the atrophy was still there.
And for the next season, so if this happened, you know, that you finish it around May, you don't go back to like September, October.
Right.
Did that affect going forward? Were you afraid to say like, oh, I kind of should probably just do these kind of sketches? And
no, I was like, I'm ready. I'm fine. You know, and just kind of went with it. You know, it's like, I'm sure there's athletes that have done that before.
Of course.
I mean, I'm certainly not an athlete, but I'm sure many athletes have.
You're a comedy athlete.
Like a comedy athlete. Sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, thank you, I guess. But, you know, it's like if you're in the game and you got an injury, you're not going to bitch about it. Like if you just had surgery and like, oh, my God, it's hurting again.
You know,
you're not going to be that person.
Right.
You're going to keep going until, you know, you're thrown unconscious and you really end up in the hospital or whatever, you know.
Because you probably think like you got to push through.
Have to push through it. Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah.
And you do not. And I was never that kid. That was a whiner or the boy who cried wolf. I mean, I was growing up like, if you have something to whine about, it better be serious, you know.
The walk it off generation.
Yeah. And my dad was a big hypochondriac and he was like, you know, a victim. He played that kind of thing. And I did not want to be that person, you know. So I much prefer, you know, bleeding than bitching about it.
Well, and also, I wonder if maybe that's why it took you so long to tell this the story.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. Well, because that was why I didn't want to be – I wanted to keep working, you know. And I think a lot of people have that story. A lot of people are the same way. They don't really reveal what was really going on until way later because they don't want their work or the relationship or anything like that, what's going on in the present, to be affected.
Right.
You know, even though it's probably the healthier thing to do to say it and admit it, you know.
Well, it also doesn't mean, like, even if you do say it, admit it, you also, you're probably afraid that you don't have any guarantees how people are going to react.
Well, that's part of it, too.
Yeah, they're either going to go, oh, my God, I'm so sorry, or they're going to go, who cares? Or,
let's move on.
Making more of it than it is, or whatever.
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's just, it's not worth it, you know, at first. It's just not worth it, you know. It's like being in a relationship where you're in love with someone and you find out that you're not, I don't know. I mean, I've been in love before where I think I fake something, but I try to like push off letting the other person know something.
Because you just don't want to deal with what that entails.
Yeah, because it's working so well at the time and you work so hard for it to work.
Yeah.
So well, and it's like, I don't want to mess this up.
But everyone experiences that with a relationship or a job. Yeah.
And you hope it goes away. You're like, oh, it'll go away.
Or something with a family member. It's like, well, I'll keep making exceptions. I'll keep going away. But eventually, a lot of the time, it just tips.
Well, yeah.
And you can't deal with it anymore.
Maturity, you find that out. You know, age, you find that out. Or just finding out that, you know, taking care of yourself is very important.
It's like, do you want to deal with the leaky faucet now or do you ignore it and then your pipes explode and then it's like, oh, okay, now I have a real problem.
And when you're in your 20s, you know, you think that way too.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't
fully realize all the consequences, you know, you just kind of go, oh, I guess I'll probably work out.
Yeah.
How many surgeries did you have total?
I had 5.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, altogether. So.
Are you done with them now?
Well, I would like to say that. I mean, I have to do physical therapy, which is fine, you know, and that prevents me from having any other future injuries. And I'm certainly in better shape than I have been before in regards to, you know, that injury. But I had a lot of work done, so I have to keep doing physical therapy. But there are times, you know, I'll feel, you know, if I tense up or if I, you know, everybody has their pain somewhere, you know. Mm-hmm. Some people get in their shoulders, the back. I always get in the same place, which is right on the left of my neck, you know, between my shoulder blade and my neck where the injury was. I mean, it's always there regardless of the surgeries I've had. It's just still there when I get, you know, anxious or whatever, that kind of thing. It just shows up. I know there is a screw loose somewhere in my neck, but they said that that's normal, which is weird. They said, like, think of it as what are those things where you're painting the side of a building?
Scaffolding?
A scaffolding. Yeah. Think of it as a scaffolding that needs to stay there and then eventually fall apart.
Well, I don't know if I want to think of it that way.
I know. So that's what they were saying like that. But anyway, I'm never going to be 100% again. You know, they said that from the beginning. And there are certain things I can't do. You know, I can't, like, change a light bulb over my head.
Right.
I can't go skiing. Not that I'm a big skier.
Right.
Parachuting, I guess.
Yeah. Parasailing. You know, you're fine. You're fine. Things, You'll be fine. You're fine without
right.
that.
Right. But, you know, I can't, you know, yeah, it's an injury, and that it's affected my life.
How do you live with, like, when you kind of have this baseline of pain?
Right.
And I'm sure you want to, you know, there are times when you go, well, how do I just not feel this anymore?
Right.
But then you still get up every day. You put one foot in front of the other.
Oh, yeah.
You live your life. You do. Is it sort of just living one day at a time in the present moment to moment? Or how do you make peace with that, you know, in the times when it feels overwhelming?
You just, I mean, that's the same thing about, like, the same way you deal with depression, I think, or deal with unhappiness or things you want to avoid in life. You know, you just wake up and you put on one sock and then the other, and you just go outside, and then you're like, there's the sunlight and there's my friends and, you know, things that are making it worth it. You know, the other parts of, you know, because you could spend days and whatever in bed and just sulking about it, you know, and the pain, you know, it'll always be there, whether you're lying in bed and being the victim, or you're being active and being social, you know. It'll always be there, but it's worth it to be more social and be around people that love you and being the victim in bed, you know.
And at any point, you don't want to talk about any of this.
Sure.
I just assume
that's
you
right.
do, because it's in the – I know you
yeah,
saw
yeah,
a lot
yeah.
in the book.
It's fine,
and I just kind of want to give people
yeah.
the idea, because I know
right.
also that – You struggle with addiction to the pain pills too,
sure.
which is
yeah.
entirely understandable.
Right. Well, I'm clean, of course, clean now.
Now you're clean now, but at the time.
Yeah.
But at the time.
Yeah.
Because you're, again, probably just like athletes who are like, put more cortisone in there, just numb
yeah.
the pain so I can get through what I want to do.
Of course.
What I need, what I feel like I need
yeah.
to do. You know, did you sense that that was happening, or did you wake up one day and go, oh, I think I might have a problem with this stuff?
Well, I didn't think – I didn't really have the problem until, like, the last surgery, honestly. I was very good about not – you know, because they give you – for, you know, post-op, they – you know, you're supposed to take a number of well, they have, like, morphine patches they give you, and you put mm-hmm. patches on your back and your neck, and they – I forgot what kind of – I guess it must have been oxycodone. I think they gave you oxycodone. It was, like, the highest level of – you know, because you're on a morphine drip. You're in the hospital, so once you get out of the hospital, you're on pretty much what you're taking while you're in the hospital, but you're getting off of that slowly at home, you know. And you're in a neck brace, and you're bedridden for probably about at least a month and a half, maybe 2 months. And that's the worst, too, by the way. That's just awful. To sit with your thoughts and not be physical.
And also
and
not
move.
Be able to, yeah,
ugh,
not be able to
it's
move,
so
not
bad.
Be able to distract yourself. At that point,
no,
we don't have smartphones.
Terrible. Oh, exactly, yeah. Didn't have smartphones either.
So it's like you can't, you, as
right.
much as you want to distract yourself at any minute, you're just,
yeah.
just lying there.
It was awful. Yeah, it was so, it's so terrible.
And are you having to navigate all of the – because in as much as you can try to run away from things, you can try to distract yourself.
Right.
Sort of like we were talking about with the plumbing issue, at a certain point, you do have to deal with stuff. Emotionally, you
of course.
Do have to process
yeah.
those things.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
at a certain point, did you have to start getting through that, or did you – were you just like, yeah, I don't want to feel any pain, so I'm just going to take another thing?
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, that – Yeah, I didn't want to feel it. I think I was kind of like giving up a little bit, you know, giving up. And because I just didn't, I wasn't working so much. And I was like, I felt like the damage was done, you know.
This was post SNL.
Yeah. This is, yeah, no, because I didn't get on, you know, the pill stuff till way later, maybe like 6 years ago, probably.
Mm-hmm.
When I had my last surgery, maybe 5 years, about 6 years ago. And that's when, I just continued doing the pills because it was like, I just kind of gave up, you know, I just gave up caring, you know, I was like, you know, I don't know, I guess I'm just going to be this person that's, you know, in pain and, physically, you know, unable to do what I used to do, you know, and, I bought into that. You know, and that's what that, you know, being addicted, you know, you kind of buy into that as well. It helps you buy into all the negativity and all this
because
self-doubt.
It helps justify why you're giving up. So it helps helping you justify the pattern.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And it makes you not break out of the pattern. Obviously, it makes you stay in the pattern. And it's a very sick place, obviously, you know, because you can just end up there for the rest of your life, you know. And I saw that with my dad, too, a bit. He was very I don't think he had a problem with pills, but he had he really bought into ailments, you know. He would love any reason to go to the doctor,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just love the fact that he had something to bitch about and for other people to give him sympathy right. about, you know. And I was so not – I just never wanted to be that person. And when I got – to be more of that person, be that person, because it was really happening, because I was really having these surgeries. I gave up, you know. I really gave up. I was just like, that's it.
Were you able to start?
I'm going to be an example. I'm going to be like something referred to as like, that's really so sad about Chris. Like, too bad about Catan. Like, oh, that's so tragic, you know. What a tragedy.
And you were kind of helping to buy into that for
exactly,
yourself.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it was up to me to stop it, and I did. You know, I stopped being an addict, and I, you know, went to rehab, and I, you know, realized, you know, all the other great wonderful things in life that keep you sober, you know, and you know from every day to day, and. But it's hard, as you know, to get out of that, you know.
Of course, because it's hard. Terrible. It's hard to see it when
it's
you're
a pattern,
in it.
And especially when you have a physical ailment that needs that. That's
right.
Really hard, you know, because it wasn't recreational for me.
Right.
It was like it was actually something my body needed at the time, and then I didn't need to. But you didn't want it to rely on anything anymore. That was just it was really hard, you know, to have a real. Something really painful to not be rewarded, you
right,
know,
right?
To not get that reward, but to really like, but when you really built that muscle and you really built, you know, you really do the physical therapy. As painful as it was, when that blood starts flowing again, you're in your arm and you feel it, your fingertips and your toes. You know, it feels amazing. You feel alive again. You know, and that did come back. You know, and it has come back. So that's amazing. That feels like you're back again, you know. And it's nothing better than that.
But also there's that part, I'm sure, because as entertainers, and I don't think it's just in the entertainment business,
yeah.
but you so much attach your accomplishments to who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, as you get older, whether or not you go through stuff that kind of rips you away from that,
yeah.
you have to start to realize like, oh, I'm not my accomplishments or I'm not – like that's
right.
not my identity.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, you know – because you said, "Oh, I don't want to be the cautionary tale. Am I just this guy now?
Exactly.
Oh, he had this career, and now
yeah.
he's you know, oh, it's so sad." And so, when did you start going? When were you start able to say, "Oh, well, that's something that I did, but it's not me, and I'm not like whether or not I'm performing on a live television show every week does not make me a better or worse person.
Right?
I have value because I'm." Because I am a person who is a part of, you know, humanity, and there are things that I can appreciate and things that I can do, and I don't
yeah.
need that stuff to tell me that I'm worth anything. How did you come out of that to find your worth?
Well, I guess that was couple of years ago, probably, you know. My father passed away, and when he passed away, that was part of it. To see that too, because he really didn't take care of himself. You know, he really most of the reasons why he passed away were ailments that really were things that he could have taken care of. You know, just he never exercised. He never, you know. Well, he did exercise, but his way of exercising was. Even though charming, he'd be like, well, I walked around the block, you know, or I went swimming and it's really, he just dog paddled, or, you know, but, you know, eventually it wasn't, you know, it didn't help him. But I you know, that just really, I saw that, you know, how valuable those years are that you can have, like you really can add a lot of life to your, to the years you're, you know, enjoying by taking care of yourself, you know, physically, of course, but mentally, and just not being the victim and doing that. My dad really just went down that way, you know. It was really unfortunate, you know. I think he loved more than anything to be there was an improv he did it in the Growlings a long time ago when I was a kid, and, it was a improv class, and Gary Austin was the director or the teacher, and he said, "Okay, Kip, you're going to be on your deathbed, and in a hospital, and all the other cast members are going to, everybody else in the cast are going to come up and say their goodbyes to you, you know." And I remember him telling me like that was the greatest. He had the greatest. time. That was one of the greatest moments of his life to pretend he was dying and to have
that just so was in the square in the center of what he is.
I thought that was so
weird.
I thought that was so weird and so like I would never. How would you enjoy like lying down and having people come to you? But that was his thing. So
That was his pre-social media version of getting likes.
Yeah, that's a good way. Like, who would come visit me on my deathbed if I were dead?
Yeah. Oh, that's so fucked
up. It's so fucked up. So that was like, yeah.
So that snapped you out of it. And
that really helped me snap out of it. But also, yeah, the pain itself for me, you know. And that, you know, I was married. I'm not married now. And then. That, you know, I'd like to get married again and then have that life. You know, I'm not that old. And,
no, not
you know,
at
I'm
all.
Still, you know, I'm 48 and I have, you know, I just, I don't know. I think I just, it was a dark time. It was a lot of dark stuff going on. I mean, that's what was dark. That's what the dark stuff was just the physical, you know. I don't know how other people, I mean, when I watch people that really, like, have to deal. I mean, my pain was pretty bad, but there's some people that lose a leg and, you know, that have to, like, and they're playing basketball, you know, in their wheelchair, and like the human spirit in those situations is amazing. But I would never, I mean, I don't know what I would do if I were, I mean, I would have to find the human spirit if I were in a wheelchair and I, you know, a physical comedian now in a wheelchair would be, I don't know.
Would figure it out.
I would figure it out, I mean, yeah. But at the time, I gave up, you know? I just gave up. I was just like, I mean, imagine Jim Carrey, like, I guess he would figure it out, too.
Yeah,
I mean,
but, you know, but at the time, it doesn't feel like you're going to
figure it out. I haven't seen it before. I haven't seen a physical comedian. I mean, even Buster Keaton was like, I got a broken neck. I'm going to keep going, you know?
Right.
You know? But right. That's just how I saw it. Other people, you just keep going. Or you don't, or they, you know, they don't say anything, and then you find out later, like, oh, really? That's what was going on?
Well, when you're young.
The show must go on.
When you're
you
young,
know?
You're like a Wolverine, so you can throw yourself on the floor. I mean, it happened to Chevy Chase. You can throw yourself on the floor a million times because it gets laughs.
Sure.
And so you're going to, you know, through this sort of Darwinian natural selection process of comedy bits, oh, this works, I should do more of these.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, you know, as you start to get older, just, you know, looking to the left too fast, you could, like, you know, so throwing yourself on the floor has an effect. It's like wrestlers, like the older wrestlers, you know, it's like they sacrifice their bodies for entertainment. And so what do you do at that point?
Right.
But I do think that you would figure it out because
I would.
You're
I did.
Because you're still funny. It's like you know how to be funny.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's just how can you be fun, you know, like finding out ways to be funny without throwing yourself back in a chair.
Right.
But did you, and again, I'm only asking these questions because it's largely so that if people are going through stuff, whatever their darkest time is.
Yeah. Well, that's what I like for people to get out of the book, you know. Really, that kind of inspiration that, you know.
The survival of the process.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because there was – did you have a DUI thing?
I did, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And was that because of the pills and because of the
– Well, I was actually on Ambien that night. I wasn't on pills. Oh, but I couldn't walk the straight line because of my – I had surgery.
Right.
So that's what messed me up. You know, they gave me a breathalyzer, which I passed, but I didn't walk the straight line, you know. But what's so funny about that night is that I hit this parked car because I fell asleep. It wasn't parked car; it was one of those whatever city cars on the. And it was on the exit ramp. The exit ramp was blocked off, and I was heading in that direction. I hit the pylons.
No, you were on Ambien. Did you know you were about to drive, or did you? Did your
body?
Yeah,
it was It was a booty call.
Okay.
And the
so you
woman
took the Ambien and someone said come over.
Well, I was already on Ambien.
Oh, gotcha.
And
gotcha.
Woke me up and I was like, hey, do you want to come over? And she, you know, I said, I'm really tired. And she's like, well, will you come over here if you want anything? I'm like, well, you know, really? I mean, it wasn't just.
Was this pre-Uber?
Yes, it was.
Okay, gotcha.
Oh, definitely pre-Uber.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because now it would have been a different story.
Oh, yeah. No, of course I would take an Uber. You know, but when I had the accident, there happened to be a police car just down the way on the freeway, and they pulled somebody over. So I ran over from my car to the policeman, and I said, hey, I just got in a car accident. And then he was like, wait, what's going – like, but I was never pulled over.
Oh, which that's is so interesting.
Weird. Yeah, I actually volunteered my accident and said, hey, I just had an accident.
Gold star for good citizenship.
Hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
And then one of the cops pulled out his iPhone and started filming me. While the other cop was making me do the line, so then they sold that to TMZ, which is nice. So be aware that the policemen do like to film you.
Oh my gosh! And so,
isn't that crazy?
Now, on top of that, now you're probably dealing with a certain amount of public shaming.
Exactly.
On top of that, and
right.
So is this,
yeah, and yet nobody knew about the surgeries yet.
And at that time, did you feel like saying like, "Hey, maybe I should tell the story now"?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and of course, yeah. Well, that was previous to even beginning to think of writing a book, too, which is what made me want to write the book.
Right.
Like, it's enough. I really have to tell people what's going on. And I don't ever want a situation like that where they don't know, you know, like, you know, that why are you on pain, you know. And if someone were to find out why you're on pain meds after, you know, you're in the hospital, you may want to tell them that you had surgery.
Because people will just assume the shittiest reason about you.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he was on the show, and then he wasn't on the show, and so he got addicted. It's like, it's not. That's not the narrative, guys. That's not the narrative.
Yeah, and that's really why everyone should write a book. Really?
Well, everyone has a story. And,
did you write a book?
I did write a book.
Did you write a book?
Yeah, I wrote a book like 8 years ago or something.
What was it you really wanted to let people know?
I wanted to let people know because, you know, it was – I decided, like, rather than just writing an autobiography, that it would sort of be an autobiographical self-help book. Like, here's what you know, like, I kind of pulled myself out of an addiction swamp.
So you did write about addiction.
I did,
yeah. Okay,
here are things that I did. Right. Here are things that I learned about how, like, if you have an obsessive kind of nerdy brain and you're able to hyper-focus on stuff as nerds or addicts are able to do, here's how you can sort of refocus that in constructive ways. Or at least this is what I did.
Right.
I'm not saying that everything's going to work for you.
Of course.
But it is because I think, you know – because being connected to other people, I think, is a large part of what humanity is about. Like, the purpose of life is life, I think.
Yeah.
And sharing experiences. And if you go through things or you make mistakes or you learn from stuff or you go through stuff, you know that X number of people are also going through that or worse.
Right.
And so it is that sort of like the best you can do, not only to make it worth it for yourself, but worth it in the sort of universal sense is like – you know, you write this book, you tell your story, and a percentage of people who read this book will go, oh my God, you may help divert where it would have been helpful for you if someone stepped in and said, Chris, this is a bad path. I'm going to need you to not do this. Maybe you would have listened, maybe you wouldn't, but at least that fork in the road would have been created. And that's what you do for people.
I hope so.
Who will go, you know, oh my God, I think I may have lost everything for, you know, something that, you know, wasn't my fault and I don't know what to do. And, you know, ah, there's hope. You know, Catan got through it.
Who was a physical physical comedian and was all about how he appeared.
Right.
Know? It was all about appearance.
Yeah.
Being on, you know, on Saturday Night Live.
Did it make you a more open person, more open to sharing your life, your experiences, like as they happen, rather than being the opposite of what you said your father was?
Especially when you know it's okay to tell the truth, you know, tell the truth.
And ask for help?
Yeah. Ask for help. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there were, I mean, you know, and in the book I talk about it too, there's some relationships where I had to be, I had to ask, like, you know, my girlfriend to bathe me, you know, and it was so humiliating. Oh, it's just so, it's so debilitating and it's so humiliating. It's really, when you don't think you have help.
Right.
But that was my fault, you know, because I didn't let everyone know, you know. I don't know if it would have been different. It probably would have been very different, but I just didn't want people to know, you know, because I didn't want to be taking, I didn't want anybody's help. I was just like, no, no, I'm fine. I was that, no, no, I'm fine guy.
Right.
Yeah, like, oh, no, don't worry about me. You know,
right.
I'll be all right. That kind of person, which is not, it's hard to be that person that asks for help.
Are you able to not beat yourself up about choices that you made before anymore? Are you able to?
Yeah, now. I am. Yes.
Good. Yeah. Because I'm sure, you know, like when.
It takes a long time to learn how to be, treat yourself well, you know, mentally and physically, you know. It does, you know, and not beat yourself up about bad choices or.
Right.
You know, making mistakes or, you know, all that stuff, you know.
Did you, in your mind, when you're lying in bed for all those months, what, if you, and you're sort of replaying the regrets in your head, what are you saying to yourself? Like, I should have X, Y, or Z. I should have just taken more time off. I should have done this. I should have done that.
I don't know. I don't know if I should have just been more, well, no, I should have just said, hey, I should have just been more open about it on when it happened on SNL, I think, you know. I should have just been more, you know, I really messed up my, I should have called SAG. It's what I should have done. That's what I should have done.
But now.
I should have called Screen Actors Guild.
But now because you.
Or after, at the time, sorry.
I think I broke my neck.
Yeah.
I did break my neck.
I should have done that.
But you just didn't want
to. No, I was like, well, I had to tell the producers of SNL, or I told, you know, I told, yeah, I told them and I said that, you know, this happened and they said they'll take care of it. And I thought that was enough, you know, and they did. They, you know, they did take care of it.
Right.
So I thought that was fine. But I really didn't want anyone to know. I just did, like, not that you would feel judgment from, I can't explain it. Even though, like, everyone's such a close friend and the cast and the writers were friends, you would still feel just, I mean, at least I would still feel judged, you know, but that's my problem. I don't think I'd. Get judgment. I don't know.
You felt there was no...
Like if someone knows you can't do it, you can't do it.
You felt there was no space to be vulnerable or show...
No, it wasn't that kind of a place.
Right.
I mean, I don't think there's a lot of that in comedy in general anyway. I mean, you know, I don't know if it really breeds that, you know.
Right.
I don't think the industry breeds that either.
Well, because really momentum in the business is very hard to achieve.
Yeah.
And when you do, and you don't want to lose it.
Right.
And if you do, it's hard to get back. And it's not impossible. You can certainly get it back, but.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's that is completely.
Yeah, you don't want to. And then it happens still. Like, I'm sure, like, Adele doesn't tell everyone when she hurts her wrist.
And it's not like any. It's not like any of those people would actively be like, let's. Shun Chris Kattan, but it's just like, oh, but let's not include him in this stuff because
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, you don't want to. That's the biggest fear is like when you work that hard to get there, you don't want to be replaced, you know. And that's it's easy to be replaced if that happens.
But I hope that you are able to, and it sounds like you are, that everything that you went through, if you hadn't gone through all of that, I would imagine that through your sobriety now and through the work that you're doing on yourself, would you say that you're experiencing more of a centeredness than you have ever experienced before?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So if you hadn't gone through all of that, then maybe you would never have experienced this kind of, like, connection to life that you feel now.
That's probably true, yeah. I mean, yeah, it does take something like that in order to feel
I'm not saying
centered.
That it's good that it happened, and I hope that's not too Pollyanna approach, but it also – you know.
Well, you need to go through something like that in order to feel centered. Some people do, at least, you know, if you're, not that I was out of touch, but like that, you know, I do did need to find some grounding, I think, you know. I think maturity, obviously that's going to mature you, some that kind of an event. So, I mean, things happen for a reason, for whatever reason, you know. Maybe I need to just slow down. I don't know.
Are you doing stand-up? Are you doing stand-up?
I am. I am still doing stand-up. Yeah,
yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Good, good, good. Yeah, yeah. How many shows are you doing a year?
Oh, let's see. I don't know. It varies. I'll go do like 2 weekends, maybe every 2 months, maybe.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I and are the people that are coming to the shows, do they expect to see, do you do characters in the act? Or
I do a little bit. Like I'll do Mango a little bit, but I'm not going to put on the outfit, you know.
Right, 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 right.
But they, you know, I think they, some of them already know about the injury, I think. Now they do. But I think some people notice, because I'm not like, you know, I have a fear of like, one of the last things I had to get rid of was the idea that I'm a bit of a hunchback, you know, because mm-hmm. like I can lean over sometimes. And that's just how my back is sometimes, you know, when I'm not thinking about sitting up straight, which I should obviously do more often. But I think that people, and people have, like, after the show will say, like, hey, is your back okay? And, you know, because you look like you're, because my mobility is a little restricted. I can't, you know, just a little bit. It's not like I can still bop my head and do stuff like that, like Roxbury guys, but I can't. So there's a sense of I'm not as agile as I used to be.
Yeah, those questions, you know, never help. I mean, I know people are trying to show concern, yeah, but it does just sort of poke.
They're like, hey, yeah, are you okay? Or they hand you a chiropractor card, which is weird.
Yeah, because basically what they're saying, like, what's wrong with you?
Exactly.
And why?
You don't want that.
Why is something wrong with you?
You're like, watching the show. Please, like, hey,
just, yeah, can we just
like
sort of focus
Bruce Springsteen doesn't want to, like, hey, I love your performance. Here's a chiropractor card. I saw a little, it looked like your hand didn't work so well up there.
Yeah, it's like when people tell you, hey, man, you look tired.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, my God.
Why is that helpful? How's that helpful?
Worse.
I know I'm tired. Why is that helpful?
You look tired.
I'm just telling you because I care. No, please.
Oh, that's the worst. What a rude comment.
In parentheses. You look like
hey,
shit.
Hey, are you
yeah,
okay?
I get it. Yeah.
Are you sure you're okay?
I'm just showing concern. I didn't ask.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now I'm just self-conscious about right. it. Please just.
Right. I don't want sympathy.
Please just say, hey, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. Exactly, I had a good time. Yeah. I had a good time at the show. Yeah. So what, like, what direction, like, how has your comedy evolved in the last few years? Like, what types of things are you writing? Is it, are you just story-based? Is it more joke-based?
It's more story-based, yeah. It's more story-based. I was never really I found myself being – I mean, I didn't do stand-up until after, you know, after SNL. So I didn't start doing – you know, I was doing sketch and improv. That's where I started. So.
I mean, I remember seeing you at a show like, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago, maybe almost 10 years ago. It's just like an alternative show, like at an art gallery or something.
What was it? Stand-up show?
Yeah, it was stand-up show.
Oh,
yeah, it was a
okay,
stand-up
I
show.
I wasn't very good. I'm sure I wasn't good.
I don't remember because
I hope you don't remember.
Because the comedians were held separately from the showroom.
Oh.
So you couldn't see – like the comedians were
–
like the green room was like in a different – it was a gallery, so they had had the
comedians. Was this in Chicago or
something?
No,
it was in L.A.
Oh, okay.
So the comedians, like, you couldn't see or hear the show because it was in a different – we were kept in a different room.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah.
So I don't know.
I don't know how I did.
I don't know what anybody else did during that show.
Were you performing?
I did, yeah.
And I performed?
You were also performing, yeah.
What this was.
Yeah.
Oh, was it like a benefit or something?
Probably. Might have been.
Yeah.
But you know, just because there were so many alternative shows in Los Angeles, it's like,
right.
You know, there was a show at a laundromat. There was a show at a gallery.
There were
shows at a comic book shop.
Trader Joe's.
Exactly. It was just
right.
Over in the produce section. You're just telling jokes and handing people out of jokes.
Mm-hmm.
But, and is the stand-up, is it fulfilling? Like, does it feel like, oh, this is kind of like a different, because I'm always fascinated by people who come from a team comedy background to then just solo.
Yeah. It's fulfilling. I mean, it's not nearly as fulfilling for me as it is doing sketch comedy, though, or doing film or, you know, doing, you know, I like it a lot. I really enjoy it. But my, I'm better. I think I'm just better off. I think I'm not better off. I think I'm better at doing stuff with people. I'm better at my gift is more with sketch comedy and you know, doing situation comedy, or you know, doing a sitcom or in a film, or you know, I think I'm better that way.
Do you have a spot playing a role
as opposed to delivering jokes?
I think I'm better.
Yeah, better doing characters and performing and acting.
Can you drop in on the Groundlings when you feel like it?
I haven't done that in a while, though. Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I got to call somebody and say, can I be the guest in the Thursday night improv show? Yeah.
Have you thought about touring with a couple of the SNL writers, a couple of the old SNL folks? Like, just touring, like, a few people sketch or improv show?
I don't know how that would work.
Well, I mean, it's, you know.
You know, I mean, they would be, I don't know. See, again, I'm probably, like, fearful of, like, they're too busy.
I don't know. If you don't ask, I just sort of think, you know, like, if you like doing sketch, there must be a way for you to take more sketch on the road.
I have to figure out a way to do more sketch with my stand-up, you know. I don't know how to. That's what I got to figure out.
You should. I don't mean you should.
Sure, I will.
Billy Crystal had a stand-up special in the 80s where it was all sketch characters. They were all sketches.
Oh, okay,
and
right.
And he worked with – and Whoopi Goldberg too.
Right. I remember her woman.
But Billy's was, you know, like he did a lot of stuff with like working off pre-recorded stuff, like audio stuff. And I saw Johnny Carson in the 70s when I was a kid. My parents took me to see him in Vegas. Wow. And he was not a stand-up per se, but he did some sketches where there was like a pre-recorded thing that he was playing off of. I don't know. I feel like – and please tell me to shut up.
But I just –
it seems like there's a way to – feels like there's a way to slide more of that in your act that might be a little more fulfilling to
you. That's a good idea.
If you wanted to.
No, I think that's what I would like to do. Something like that is a good idea. Yeah.
Do you like improv or just...
Yeah, I do. I do enjoy improv. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you?
I mean,
You're more stand-up.
I'm more stand-up. I tried to do Groundlings for a while and I...
Were you in the classes?
I started taking the classes and then they... I did one of those Thursday night gas shows.
Yeah.
Where they have a guest come in, probably what you were talking about too, where you have a guest come in and you're sort of the guest.
Mm-hmm. Cooking with Gas.
Cooking with Gas, And Karen Mariyama was working on something with her, so she brought me in. Yeah. And they let me just continue doing the gas shows.
Right.
Which the gas shows typically are for people who are waiting to go between like level 3 and 4, I think. Or there are people who are waiting to get into
the
Sunday
cast,
company.
Growling's cast members? Yeah.
And so it's a much higher level than I probably should have been allowed in.
Right.
And I realized, like, I love riffing, but the structure of the way I write, I'm the opposite of you. I don't necessarily like being characters. I like being me. Mm-hmm. And I like being responsible for everything myself, which is not good if you need to be a part of a team.
Right, right.
And so...
Which is probably why you're better at stand-up than that. I mean, not that you're not...
You can always tell a stand-up in an improv scene because they'll come in and go, I'm an astronaut and that guy over there works in a bakery. I mean, it's fighting the urge to control the scene with jokes.
Right. That's a good thing. Yeah.
So that's – I'm more of a stand-up.
Right. Well, as you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because even if you're a good riffer, when you start like getting into the rules of improv, you realize like, oh, it turns out I don't know anything about him, like the way that improv is supposed to be done.
Right.
Because it's different than just riffing jokes in a room with other comedians.
Yeah, you are in control. You like to be in more control then, I guess.
I think so, just because I just like the idea of knowing where stuff is going to go.
Yeah.
And being able to break the fourth wall.
Yeah.
Being able to fall back on jokes if I need to.
Right.
And, you know... I think improv is a good skill that every performer should learn how to cultivate.
Yeah. I mean,
some people are just naturally better at it.
It helped you regardless, though. I mean, improvisation.
A million percent.
In writing as well, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Were there any sketches? Did you ever think about pulling out sketches that maybe didn't make it on SNL that you could drop on the road? Like, hey, this is a sketch that we almost did but didn't do. Like,
I never thought about that. Yeah, I guess I could. I mean, I had a character called the Coffee Guy. Just drank a lot of coffee. He looked like he was all drugged out, but he was just drinking coffee from a coffee pitcher. I don't know.
There's something in there, man.
There's a lot of characters I did at SNL. I mean, Groundlings that were... Oh, I did a lot of children. I remember Karen Mariamis told me like, not do children. Don't do children. I remember doing a sketch where I was a little kid urinating. And I had a little squeezy bottle, like a little, you know, you don't face the audience and you pee on the wall. I don't know. That was a character. That was one character.
Just try it.
Maybe I'll just pretend I'm peeing in my stand-up and I'm not. It's just a squeezy bottle.
Yeah.
That's my character.
Or just pee all over the stage and then spike the microphone and walk off stage. How was the show? It was like 4 minutes long and pissed on stage and threw the microphone down. People were like, oh my God, I got to see this guy.
Minutes. Yeah.
I really got to see this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's, like, you know, to sort of wrap this up on a forward-thinking,
sure.
positive, yes. happy.
Or we could end it on something very negative. So let's just end it on something very depressing, if you don't mind.
In the end, I realize nothing means anything anyway. Okay, thanks, everyone. It was really great to be here. Right. It was really great to be here. But, I mean, you know, in general, you said you're feeling better. In general, you said kind of talking about this must have dislodged some
sure.
stuff for you as well.
Oh, yeah. It was very cathartic and, you know, I mean, yeah, it was a great deal. I don't have to talk about myself so much anymore, too. You're kind of like, after writing something like that, you're like, you don't need to, you're kind of bored with your past.
Right.
You know, you don't really need to bring it up again.
That's really significant.
I think that's a good thing, though, right?
It's an incredibly good thing because you can't, I feel like a lot of our adult lives is so much about being imprisoned by the things that
true.
We feel bad about
yeah.
when we're younger. And at a certain point, you're either forced to let go or right. you just have to decide to, let it go.
Yeah. And there's something about putting it all on paper and having other people read it that they know now, if they choose to know, that you can only talk about stuff that's in the present or in the future, really.
What are you excited about right now? Like, what are you? What kind of gets you going?
Oh, the new Star Wars.
At Disneyland or the new Star Wars movie?
The movie, but.
Yeah.
What gets me going? Well, you know, I'm excited about being, I don't know, just able to, I don't know. I'm happy. I'm excited that I'm still funny, or I think I am, that I'm still able to, I don't know. I just like who I am, and I'm excited about the rest of my life. And
that's a huge deal.
You know, yeah.
I mean, that sentence right there
sure.
is a very huge deal, and most people, a lot of people cannot say that with sincerity.
I guess not.
And that's a fucking enormous...
Well, I wouldn't be able to just say it years ago, probably.
Right.
You know. So, yeah, I am excited about who I am, about the rest of my life.
That's
you know, I have not married. I'd like to get married again and be in love again and you know, and
there's no reason you won't be.
You know, exactly. There is no reason. But before, I would have thought, oh, it's never going to happen again. You know,
we just create those.
Exactly.
We create those things in our head because we're afraid. Like the possibility of rejection is so painful that it's easier just to like knock all the pieces on the floor and go, I'm not going to play this anymore. It's never going to happen. It's like,
but you don't know
that. You're just trying to control the future with a false narrative to protect yourself.
Yeah.
But you're hurting yourself.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're not allowing yourself to enjoy. Exactly. Yeah.
I'm happy for you. And
oh,
as
thank
someone
you.
That I always greatly enjoyed running into, as we've run into each other many times over the years, you've always been so kind. And even in 2001, you let me taggle. I followed you around Aspen like a puppy because I was just so enamored of, you know, your comedy prowess and, you know, you're this big SNL guy and you're talking to me, you know, like it was really fun. And and that to me says so much about your character and who you are that, I'm sorry that you had to travel the path that you did, but I'm so happy for you that you're now in this place and ready to, you know, continue on with the rest of your life.
Yeah, me too. And thank you for acknowledging that. That means a lot.
Are you
much more spiritual? No, I don't know. Metaphysical?
Maybe metaphysical. Maybe just, I don't know.
Yeah, more of a metaphysical person than I anticipated.
Is it, is there anything you're pitching or anything you want to make?
Oh, what I want to make? I don't know. Well, there's a show that I might be doing in the fall. Well, I'm not supposed to talk about that, though.
Oh, okay.
Because
all right, well, there's a thing. There's a thing.
And, But there's that thing. I think it's going to happen.
It's never over, though. I think
it's not over.
It's never over. You're lying in bed
of course.
With a debilitating injury.
Sure.
And you must feel like the world has completely crumbled around you. And like you said, I'm going to be this guy forever. And the fact is...
But I'm not that. I'm not you made debilitating. It through that. Exactly. I went through that, yeah.
And now...
That was the toughest part of my life. That's what I think. I mean, if there's anything that's going to be tough, I doubt it'll be as tough as that. I mean, it might be emotionally. I don't know what's going to happen. But that was something that really makes you strong, you know, and stronger. And it makes you want to live life, you know, so... Whether I wanted to get through it or go through it or experience it or not, you know, I did. And it has I've come out the other end feeling good. So,
well, I'm glad. And I don't think the final chapter of your story is going to be, oh, that guy.
Yeah. I don't think so either. No, I mean, I know it won't be, you know, I did think that years ago, but you know.
Don't believe the hype about yourself.
Okay.
No, I mean when you're in those dark moments,
Right.
You can choose to not believe that stuff, even though it feels real. You can choose to not believe that stuff.
That's true. And everybody should know that or have those dark times.
Well, thank you for being here, Chris Kattan.
And you should do a therapy. Not every show has therapy. Is every podcast therapeutical?
Some are more fucking around. Some are more. But, you know, like I think the only reason that I felt like it was okay to talk about this stuff is because it's in your book, which is called Don't Hurt Me.
Exactly, yeah.
Which, of course, is a play on the Night of the Roxbury.
Yes.
But I also think it's important, again, like I said, for folks to know that – you know, whatever it is that they think they're facing that feels insurmountable, they can get through. And in as much as you inspire people with your comedy before, now you inspire people with your story.
Right.
On top of your comedy. And I think that's an important takeaway. So that's why.
Well, thank you.
You know, like I'm always very hesitant to like, I don't ever want it to seem like I'm going to get a good story out of it. It's just more like, I just want to make sure you're okay. And I just want to make sure that other people feel okay.
Yeah. That's great. That's very sweet.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chris Kattan, for being here. You are kind as well, and I hope to see you more socially, and I hope to be able to perform with you.
Yes, I would love that. Of course. Right.
The end.
Oh, is that it?
That was it, I guess. We can have a less formal ending.
No, that's fine.
Was
that a camera, or that was a phone?
No, it's just a recorder. It's just a microphone, yeah. We could sort of do that. We could do the fake chatter when a talk show is going to commercial.
Oh, is that... Okay.
Yeah, there's no camera anywhere, but as the camera pulls back and it starts to be, we'll be right back. Loverboy is performing, and where we at? Okay.
Then,
that was really good. Spring. I don't know. You win. And we're clear. And then then we don't talk anymore.
That was the ID10T podcast number 1007 with Chris Kattan, and this is Word Salad Rap. What an incredible story of... that he just had to live with for so long. And I'm so glad that he shared that story. I'm so glad he talked about it in his book. I'm so glad he talked about it on the podcast, because I think there's a couple of key pieces that are excellent takeaways for you and whatever it is that you're going through. Number one, don't be afraid to ask for help. There's nothing wrong with asking for help. If you feel overwhelmed, if you feel like you don't know what to do, if you feel lost. We are a communal species. We need collaboration. We need help. Sometimes you're that help for other people, and there's nothing wrong with asking for help for yourself. You deserve it. You're worth it. So ask for help if you feel like you need it. It's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength. So please, 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 please do that. And then the other thing is that This is sort of my one of the things that I took away from the podcast with Chris is you don't have to be what happens to you. Does that make sense? It's like he was saying, like, I didn't want to be that guy. I didn't want to be the guy that, you know, whatever, used to be on SNL and had a career, and now I was just this guy who was stuck in bed that didn't know what he was going to do with the rest of his life. And then he made the choice not to be the thing that happened to him. It was a thing that happened, and he used it to grow and to make him stronger. And that's honestly sometimes the best we can do. And that is a good thing to do. It's an amazing thing to be able to do. And it's a skill set that if you can cultivate will serve you and, you know, can make you indestructible to a lot of things that happen in the world, because you'll just get through it. It's just that, you know –
that Ryan Holiday book, The Obstacle is the Way. The obstacle becomes the way. Your obstacles become your way forward, but they don't have to define you, and you don't have to be them, and you don't have to be trapped in that. You, in a lot of instances, obviously not in every instance, but in a lot of instances, you do have the choice to figure out how you're going to perceive that situation, how you're going to use it to move forward, and how you're going to use it to strengthen you. And that as a result of it, you won't necessarily be defined by that thing, but by your strength through that thing. And how empowering is that? So, you know, I just want you to be able to take care of yourself. You know, I want you to be able to understand that you deserve to practice self-care. Because I feel like sometimes people maybe subconsciously do the opposite because they feel like they think that's what they deserve. But you don't deserve that. No one deserves that. And so, you know, don't be afraid to ask for help, and don't be afraid to redefine who you are and what your circumstances are, what you want to become, and how you're gonna use those things. Because you never, I mean, it's like the thing with Chris, you know, who could have known that's what he was going through? And also it teaches you, like, hey, maybe just whenever you hear something, you don't have the whole story on it. So maybe reserve judgment until that time, you know, because like with him, it's, you know, people heard about the DUI or people heard that he was struggling with addiction to pain medication or whatever. They might have just been like, ah, those actors, they're all the same. They all go down in a fiery flame of addiction and blah, blah, blah. And they're all fucked up. And they're all, it's like, no, he was dealing with a horrible thing that, I mean, to live with pain that is just a part of his existence. That's just it's just the thing that he carries around all the time. You know, it's part of the human struggle. It's part of the human story. You know, we make so many allowances for ourselves and yet so often are quick to judge other people. Like, yeah, you know, I'm different though, because my circumstances are mine. It's like, no, everyone has circumstances, you know? And in his case, you know, I'm so glad he told the story, because otherwise people might have just written him off, because, you know, we get lazy. It's easy to sort information that way. But I'm so glad that he did not, that he embraced being this version of himself and not being defined by that thing and sharing the story. And you can share your story too. Sharing your story is also asking for help. That's a version of that too. So again, don't be afraid. You are worth it. You deserve help if you need it. And you will also in turn help others when they need it. And that is a part of our human story. And you are a significant part of that story. So thank you for listening. I hope these are helpful to you in any way, by the way. I mean, listen, whatever sounds dumb to you or doesn't make sense, just forget about it, discard it, throw it away. But if you can take even small little nuggets and that inspires you to talk to other people or share that information or gain some insight in your own life, then great. I certainly enjoy talking about this stuff. So thank you for listening if you did. And if you did not, no hard feelings, no judgment. I fully understand. You wouldn't even hear me say no hard feelings, but just know that I'm feeling that for you. And thanks. Have a great week, and I'll see you in your ears real soon.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly, crying,
lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.